Next up on This Week in Law, we've got a really fascinating show for you. We're going to go deep on what happens to your digital assets when you die. We've got two great experts on that topic with us, Naomi Kahn and Susie Walsh. Evan Brown and I are here as well. We'll look at your digital estate and how to manage it. Who do you want going through your email after you're gone anyway? We'll talk a bit about marriage markets and also about how the IRS is going to treat Bitcoins, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 252, recorded March 28, 2014, Stopping the TP Avalanche. Hi, folks. Denise Howell here, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. You know, we're here each week to help you deal with and understand that troubling intersection between technology and law. And one issue that comes up over and over again is what happens to people's social media accounts and passwords beyond the grave. So we have two great experts to help us understand that topic. Try and get our arms around it today. We'll hit on some other topics too, but I think that's going to be our central focus for today. And our experts today are going to tag team it for us. Starting out the show, we have Naomi Kahn, who is a professor at George Washington University and just a comprehensive author and expert in this field. So, Naomi, it's great to have you with us today.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Also with us is Evan Brown from Chicago, Illinois, and the Info Law Group. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. Hope your Friday afternoon is going well. This ought to be a interesting topic to cover, so I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, it comes up so much, and we've, you know, sort of scattershot covered stories about this on the show before as things have come up. But we're at an interesting juncture right now in time, and Susie Walsh in the second part of the show will help us understand more about why. Susie is on the Uniform Law Commission and chairs its drafting committee on fiduciary powers and access to digital assets. So they're trying to help the states in the United States make sense of all this. And they're hoping that the states don't go off and do things on their own without a whole lot of guidance and uniformity. Naomi, can you kind of set the stage for us? Tell us why this is a big deal and why people need to be thinking about it if they're not already.
Most people actually, although 90% of Americans are online in some way or another during our lifetimes, most of us don't think about what will happen. Oh, gee, what happens if I'm suddenly hospitalized and unable to pay all of my bills online? Or what happens when I die, what happens to my Facebook account? And so it's a huge looming problem, but most of us don't like thinking about what will happen if we're no longer able to take care of all of our digital property ourselves. It's just, I mean, think of how few people have wills. Even fewer people have thought about what happens to their social media sites, to their online banking bills, to their online bill payment, to their social media accounts, and to their iTunes downloads when they're no longer there to manage them. So it's a huge problem, and some states have started to try to think about what to do when someone can't manage all of these internet accounts. But we're at a very early stage of figuring this all out. If you ever had a Facebook friend who died recently reminding you that it's your Facebook friend's birthday, I mean, it's creepy, it's unpleasant, but it's generally quite sad. And it's a reminder that there are ways of dealing with this, but you have to plan for them in advance. It's really hard to pick up the pieces if no one has done planning.
Well, let's start with a little how-to on the planning, because it seems to me like it must be extraordinarily complicated to get a handle, a complete and comprehensive handle on your online life. I have tried to do so. I say this as someone who is trying to be forward-looking with this and has tried to at least inventory what's out there and how the passwords are managed and try to create some kind of record that could be passed along as part of our family's estate planning. And it is complicated. I mean, you have your main email account, you have your primary social media's accounts, but every other day or so, something comes up and I go, oh yeah, there's an account that, you know, I haven't used in a while. And yes, it's still active. And yes, there's stuff in there that should be taken into account here. And so I think just getting a handle on it all is quite a daunting task, isn't it?
That's the first step that we recommend, is inventorying all of your digital assets. And as you said, it's incredibly hard because as soon as you think you've got them all covered, you open up another online account with yet another slightly different password from the 35 other passwords that you have. And it then becomes a problem of how exactly do you keep track of all of this? And then how do you integrate it with whatever else you're planning to do with your assets in case something happens to you? So you've taken the first step, which is to inventory your entire digital footprint. What else have you done? I mean, how have you done it? Do you subscribe to an online service? Have you, without revealing secrets, have you written down a list somewhere?
Yeah, I have. I've written down a list. It's both cryptic in its text and password protected. So because I kind of think of this list as still a work in progress that's not done. And I need to shape it up into something that would be more usable by, you know, our estate lawyer, my husband, whoever else, my son someday. Whoever else might need to use it. And it's just, it's not there yet. And I'm wondering, well, how do you ever get it there? It's quite a task. But what do you recommend?
I don't have one particular recommendation, but there are a variety of different techniques that people use. One is some people just write down the list and they write it in pencil because passwords change whenever you're prompted to change a password. And so you want to be able to easily change them. And they actually share the written list with a trusted person. So that's an extremely low-tech way of going. And it also means that you have to completely trust the other person to whom you give the names of all of your accounts and all of the passwords. You can then do something like that, store it on your computer with a password, and then put the password into a safe and make sure that somebody knows where that password is. There's a continuum of different options in terms of inventorying and then protecting. And then there are, in this brave new world, a series of internet companies that have grown up that will help you. They'll do everything from help you come up with new passwords and protect those passwords to keep track of all of your passwords. And there are even digital lockers that will let you write letters to be released when something happens to you to let people know where all of these assets are. So you can go from the very low-tech, keeping a list yourself, to the very high-tech of storing it all online. Many of these companies are free for a certain period of time or up to a certain amount of information. And then after that, you pay for their services. They're all relatively new. They're very easily accessible. CNET has a whole listing of what these various companies are, so you can just go on CNET and see which one seems to fit your needs. So I recommend whatever it is somebody feels comfortable with doing, but the the thing I strongly recommend is starting to get a handle on all of this. Kind of related to that is something that, I mean, true confessions, I don't do. I don't know, Denise and Evan, if every time you sign up for a new account, if you very carefully and laboriously go through all of the terms of service agreements that you are clicking through when you say, I agree. At True Confession, I mean, now since I've been doing this work now for several years, I've started to pay a bit more attention to this. But even I don't go through all of those different terms of service, terms of use agreements. And sometimes those terms of service agreements will say things like, you agree that nobody else can ever access this account. You will not give somebody else your password. Go look at the Facebook terms of service agreements and you'll see something similar. They may also say that this is a license and the account expires upon your death. So the terms of service agreements are incredibly important. And so in addition to inventorying what it is you have, what your passwords are, you should also have some idea of what the different internet service providers, what the different accounts say with respect to what will happen if you can't manage the accounts yourselves. Go ahead.
That's a really excellent point and goes to the ULC committee that you and our next guest, Susie Walsh, are on, dealing with putting forth some kind of uniform law for access after someone's death, that law may well conflict with what are now the terms of service in place on most of these sites.
It is, as you're doing this, I want to go back to sort of what some of the steps are in terms of planning. But as you're doing this planning, it does, as you're doing this inventory, you need to know what precisely, what kind of interest you have in each of your accounts. Do you have a license, for example? Do you have, say, some kind of digital media, which the terms of service say this is personal to you, and not only can nobody else access it, but when you die, this dies with you, and there is nothing for you to pass on. So, I mean, that seems to be a fairly clear contractual type of arrangement where you only get to use something during your lifetime. In terms of the Uniform Law Commission's process, our concern is less with what precisely you own than with the need for your fiduciary, your personal representative, the person managing your estate, or if you're incapacitated, the person taking care of all of your business activities for you. Our concern is, will that person actually be able to access all of the information that person needs? I mean, if you do online bill paying, for example, that person needs access to your passwords for getting into your online bill accounts to make sure that, say, if you have a credit card bill that's overdue, you're not going to be incurring fees into the foreseeable future when you're no longer even able to use your credit card. So, I mean, our primary concern is making sure that the person who's managing all of your, the person who's managing your estate, who's managing your financial issues, has access to all of the information that that person needs. So making that person, in a day when everything was bricks and mortar, when everything was paper, it was a lot easier for that person to get access to all of this. The bills would arrive in the mail on whatever it was, a weekly, monthly basis, with everything, with many of us, I mean, two-thirds of people are doing banking and bill paying online. With that, it's much harder. Somebody has to actually get access to the accounts to be able to actually pay those bills.
It seems to me we have a few different levels of kinds of information. We've got this very important bill paying, things getting delivered, financial arrangements that are happening automatically that definitely needs to be addressed. But then on the other side of the spectrum, people live their lives in email and to some extent in the more private recesses of social media. And not all of those lives might be something that they want to be available to basically anyone after their demise. Evan, you tend to be pretty privacy focused with your approach to social media. And I'm wondering if you're concerned at all about a law that might give access that you hadn't actually granted.
Mm. Well, you know, that's a really interesting way of looking at it. The one I thought you were taking the discussion, like, you know, we've got bank accounts and stuff on one side of the aisle, and then we've got social media and other stuff, which one seems to be more necessary than the other. But I like where you're taking this question here about, you know, maybe you don't want your next of kin to have access to all of that stuff.
Sure. I mean, you used to be able to burn your letters, right?
Right. Yes.
Something that you needed to die with you, you could destroy it. You can't destroy your email archive. Only Google or whoever your ISP is can do that.
Right. Or, you know, it used to be much easier to direct that your papers be burned even. So even there, there's a sort of an intermediary, someone else, wasn't it Kafka who wanted all his papers burned after the, after his death? And they, unfortunately they were, or were not. So, me having, you know, the utmost integrity of anyone on the face of the planet, I have nothing to hide from, you know, my next of kin or whatever. So, you could see how it would be, problematic for someone who, maybe somebody who doesn't have a spouse and, you know, but then they're estranged from the rest of their family and they just have things that they want to keep separate here. So it seems like that when the analysis would take us in that direction, it would, the framework that would need to be set up would have to be carefully constructed so that it indeed does, effectuate the will of the person who set the scenario up. And I'm saying will in the generic sense there, not with the legal document as well. So it's, I think that's something that's important to consider in all this. I'd be interested to know what Naomi thinks of that.
Yeah.
I totally, it's incredibly important. And whenever Susie and I and others talk about this issue of privacy, absolutely comes up. And it is, Evan, as you said, it's, and Denise, you both said, you used to be able to burn all of your letters, but generally people didn't burn letters the day before they died because they didn't know that they were going to die. And if you just read the number of stories of people who have found old love letters or other items that their next of kin would not have wanted found, it's the same thing with the internet, only now the problem is, of course, I don't know, thousands of times bigger because we write so many more emails than letters. But it's the same privacy issue that we've been dealing with for centuries in the trusts and estates field. And even if, well, one of the things that the uniform law is, or that the model law will be providing for, is that if your will says my executor doesn't get access to my email, et cetera, well, then that's just as binding as any other provision in your will and is supposed to be respected. I know Susie will talk about this in the next hour, but another part of the model law says that if an internet service provider says that in that wonderful terms of service agreement, if there is a separate checkbox and you affirmatively state, I don't want anyone to get access to this when I'm gone, then that's also something that needs to be respected. So you don't even need a will for that. It's something that we're hoping will become part of the terms of service agreement. Sorry, Denise.
Let's talk about those terms of service agreements, because one thing you mentioned a moment ago was this, how wise it is for people to go through the terms of service of the various services that they're using and figure out if they actually have the ability under those terms to have someone other than themselves access their account, or if they have the ability to pass along whatever digital asset might be in that account per the terms. I hope that the online service providers and the Uniform Law Commission Drafting Committee on this topic knows that no one is going to do that. No one's going to go. You're not alone. You're on the committee. You're not doing it, Naomi.
Exactly. Yeah. So
how do we deal with that issue?
Well, one way is obviously an enormous amount of public education, so people know exactly what you and Evan were just talking about in terms of next of kin getting access to things that you might not want them to get access to. But another thing is some of the internet service providers are starting themselves to make this kind of notice more conspicuous. And yes, we understand and recognize that many of us don't read those terms of service agreements, but if you have to go through a separate pop-up box that says, this is what I want to have happen when I'm no longer around, then that might really help people become more aware of this. Google right now has an inactive account manager that allows you to discuss some of this, but the number of people, it's a whole separate set of steps that you have to go through. And the number of people I have spoken to in the tech world who not only haven't done anything about the inactive account manager, but don't even know about it, is astounding. And so if when you sign up for a new service, this is part of what you have to sign up for, if this is a whole separate screen, it at least starts people thinking about this issue. Now, that's something the internet service providers have to do themselves. We're certainly not requiring them to do that, but it does seem like a logical next step for them to take in order to help to protect the privacy of all of the account holders, to, and also, as well as to deal with the impact of all of everybody who is dying and what happens to their accounts. There's a lot more attention being paid to these issues. And so it seems like a logical next step. And as I said, Google's already started. Facebook's just changed its policies with respect to memorializing an account. So this is certainly something that they have recognized and that they're trying to take steps to deal with.
What's their incentive to do that other than just looking good? Because once a Facebook account user, account holder is dead, they can't really have any more meaningful information gathered from them to, you know, effectively market, be marketed to. So what, from the service provider's perspective, what, you know, why should it be doing, taking these steps?
Well, from a service provider's perspective, it might help clear the space, as it were. I mean, if you have 500,000 Facebook users who have died and their accounts are still ongoing, you might want to, if you're Facebook, you might want to do something about those accounts. People still visit. You can memorialize a Facebook account, for example. So people still very much visit those old Facebook pages. So there may be some marketing incentives. There's also a litigation prevention perspective. About 2 years ago, one of the few federal court cases to deal with this issue involved a lawsuit against Facebook in which the executor of a model, the face of Asia's estate was suing Facebook in order to get access to her Facebook page and her account in order to determine whether she committed, suicide or whether she was pushed to her death. And so Facebook has cut some kind of an incentive to avoid litigation. And then, yeah, there is the whole compassion part of this. You want to show your customers that you care about them, that you're helping think through these issues.
Let's talk about that Sahar Daftari, I think is how you might say her last name, case, because we talked about it when it happened way back when on the show. And the ultimate outcome here, what happened was this model was in England and fell to her death from a building. And her family suspected foul play, and there was some sort of coroner's investigation going on, and the executor of the estate really wanted to be able to give access to her Facebook account. They alleged it contained critical evidence showing her actual state of mind in the days leading up to her death. So whether she would have committed suicide or not, I assume. But Facebook had that blocked under the coverage I'm reading here is the Stored Communications Act was the means for blocking it. And it seems to me that there might be more of an interest where there is foul play suspected in one's demise than, you know, the privacy considerations there might have to give way to a criminal investigation, I would think. What do you think, Naomi?
Well, they're different. The law at issue there, yes, exactly, was a statute that was enacted in 1986, well, long before Facebook was created, much less even dreamt about. And the Stored Communications Act was designed to protect the privacy of account holders from the government forcing internet service providers to reveal information about them. We can see just how well that's worked out almost 40 years later when it comes to government's access to all of our emails, et cetera. But at any rate, what Facebook claimed and what the federal court accepted was that the Stored Communications Act prevented Facebook from disclosing in a civil lawsuit to private litigants the Facebook account of Sahar Daftari. Now, the Stored Communications Act does have certain exceptions, and Facebook actually asked the court to say, please issue a court order telling us that we fall or that this case falls within one of those certain exceptions so that we are at least permitted to release this information to the executors. So Facebook can't respond to private requests from third parties for information unless the account holder or the addressee has given lawful consent to the disclosure of this information. There are a few other exceptions as well. And Daftari's, the executors of Daftari's estate said, Facebook asked if they could in fact be held to have the lawful consent of Sahar Daftari so that Facebook could release the contents of the Facebook account to the personal representatives. The court ducked the issue and said that's not presented to us. Nothing precludes Facebook from deciding on its own that the executors have the requisite lawful consent. But the court said, we're not going there. We as a court are not going to say as a matter of law that the executors have the lawful consent. And so Facebook was prevented from disclosing by the Stored Communications Act. And the court said, we're just not going to say whether or not you can disclose. You can decide on your own, but we as a court are not going to say that the executors have the lawful consent that would allow Facebook to release pursuant to the Stored Communications Act.
All right. Well, as we've been mentioning, we're going to have another guest who's going to pick up the thread of your digital life after your demise. Before we let you go, Naomi, I thought it would be fun to get into some of the other research you've been doing and paying attention to intersects kind of nicely with a lot of the themes that come up on our show. Just last week, we were pointing people toward a list of terms from the future being unevenly distributed and part of it existing now, one of them being multiplex parenting, referring to a parentage that involves more than three or more genetic sources for the individual's identity. I know that you do a lot of stuff with reproductive technology. I wonder if you could just touch on what some of the interesting cutting edge issues you're seeing there are right now.
Well, this actually is going to take us a little bit outside of technology, because if you have three genetic parents, then the question becomes, who precisely are the legal parents? And so this is an example of, yet again, technology outpacing where the law is. And so one of the interesting things is, can you have more than two parents? In California, actually, you can. In Louisiana, you can. And in a few other states, in D.C., you can as well. But that's a really, really, hopefully fascinating legal issue of whether more than two people can be named to be parents. So that's definitely a legal issue presented by the technology. Another issue that is coming up in the assisted reproductive technology in the art world is what happens with respect to donor anonymity. So if you use a sperm donor or an egg donor, a lot of people have used sperm and egg donors who are anonymous. Well, with the internet, with DNA testing, it's really hard to guarantee anonymity because you can just swab the inside of your cheek, send it away to one of the DNA testing companies, and get an enormous amount of information about who your other genetic parent may be. There are also mutual registries, such as the donor sibling registry, that allow people who are members of donor-conceived families and donors to register to try to find one another. So there's a question of whether there can ever be such a thing as anonymous sperm or egg donation in this new world. And then there are all kinds of other issues coming up in the context of egg freezing. Clinics are sometimes making arrangements saying, okay, you can go through an assisted reproductive technology cycle for free if you will donate any excess eggs to other people. Those eggs then get frozen. What happens to those eggs? Who has control over those? Does the woman who provided those eggs, is there any situation in which she can have any control over precisely what happens? And then there are questions as well with the law needing to catch up to make sure that it cuts off all of the different possible parenting rights that an egg or sperm donor might have in that situation.
Yeah, my head is starting to spin as though it had itself been put in a centrifuge as you start to think about all those issues. Why don't you wrap up by telling us about the book that you have coming out soon and the research that is underlying it?
Thanks very much. Well, co-author June Carbone, our first book was about 4 years ago. It was called Red Families versus Blue Families. And we're following that up with a book called Marriage Markets, How Inequality is Remaking the American Family. And that's going to be out in early May from Oxford University Press. And what we do is we look at how economic inequality is leading to incredible differences in how people match up today from how we matched up about 50 years ago. And how does a sort of mating, how does people marry people who are like themselves, how that is likely to contribute to economic inequality. We start off from the place that families are becoming a marker of class. If you want to look at who is most likely to be married, the only group of women that have seen their marriage rates increase over the past 40 years is women in the top 5% of income. So everybody else has seen marriage rates drop. They've seen marriage rates increase. Men at the top of the income scale have also seen marriage rates go down, but not as much as men at the bottom of the economic scale. And so our book looks at how economic inequality creates these different marriage markets in which like marry like, which means that if you're at the top of the income scale, you're more likely to marry somebody else who is at the top of the income scale. And also you're more likely to have a stable marriage. So in an era where 40% of children, more than 40% of children are born outside of marriage, marriage markets make a huge difference in the likelihood of marriage to these parents.
So it seems like if that trend continues, we're looking at sort of a dystopic future.
We're looking at, we really focus in the book on the dystopic future because of the increasing economic inequality in American society. Yeah, the good news is that mobility, intergenerational mobility, hasn't changed much over the past 50 years in American society. And the really bad news about that is that generational mobility in the United States is incredibly low compared to other countries, other peer countries. And so economic inequality has implications for the non-marital child rate. It also has implications for children and for how children are being raised and the different the possibilities that they'll attend college, that they'll complete college, and then their future work and life patterns.
Tell me, this is fascinating. And I just have a couple of questions. Hopefully you can answer quickly, because Denise, I know we're trying to transition here. But tell me, what do you mean by marriage rates? What's the definition of that? Is that just measuring people who are married for the first time, or could somebody fall into the contributor of low marriage rates because they're divorced? What's that factor or that data point?
It's likelihood of getting married. So likelihood of having at least one marriage.
I see.
We do also look at, what's really fascinating is the divorce rate in the upper third of Americans, in the upper third of earners of American society, has fallen down to below where it was, or right about where it was when no-fault divorce first came in. And so there's also an incredible difference. It's not just in the number, it's not just in the rate at which people get married, depending on income and education. It's also the rate of divorce. So the divorce rate is much higher. There's a wonderful, wonderful, back to technology, little internet tool where you can predict your likelihood of divorce. It's just a little tool you can find online. And it has questions like, how old were you when you got married? What was your educational level? And what's your income level? And sort of taking just three or four different factors, this tool can spit out pretty much what your chances are. Now, of course, it's a statistic, so it doesn't say what's going to happen to you personally. But statistically, there are various predictions based on the age at which you got married, your education level, as well as how long you've been married.
That's great. And then just one follow-up question. Are we in a situation where we can't be really certain as to what's the cause and what's the effect, or could there be a mix of both? Because I'm wondering in your explanation of it, it sounds like as if we're explaining that the rate of success in marriage depends on economic status, but could it be the other way around, that there's a correlation between the lack of success in marriage and being in a low socioeconomic class?
Oh, yes. Thanks. If I said that we're talking about statistics, and one of the points we make in the book is that even if, as we move away from expectations that the woman is going to stay home inside the house and the man is going to be the breadwinner, we are moving towards expectations of more equal sharing in the household. And so that means both equal sharing of jobs and equal sharing of work within the home. And if you can't find a job, if you are unable to contribute economically and financially to a household, and then you are also not contributing in a caretaking fashion, then you're less, I suppose, desirable as a marital partner. And so we look at, we think that the primary cause of what's going on with changes in the family is economic inequality. And so our solutions focus on things like, we don't say bring back marriage by any means. What we say is bring back jobs.
There we go. And Sue, the writer, although she's usually in IRC prompting me to put our MCLA passphrases in the show. She's not even in there this week, but she tweeted me not to forget to put one in. So thank you, Sue. And we're going to make Marriage Market the first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law for those of you who like to listen to the show to get continuing legal education credit. We think that's a great thing to do. We've got some resources for you over at wiki.twit.tv under the Twill Show page. So Marriage Market will be our first way of demonstrating that you actually listened to or watched the show. And I know, Naomi, we probably need to let you go and get on with your research and helping all the rest of us understand how to manage our digital assets when we are gone. And I see that Susie is standing by, so we're going to go ahead and try and get her on to finish up the show. Thank you so much, Naomi, for joining us.
Thanks so much. I really enjoyed talking with both of you.
Yeah, thanks,
okay,
Naomi.
Take care. Bye. All right, so joining us now, we have Susie Walsh. Susie is a partner at Cummings and Lockwood in Connecticut. She also chairs the drafting committee on fiduciary powers and access to digital assets that Naomi, our earlier guest, also serves on. Welcome to the show, Susie.
Thanks so much, Denise. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. So this whole question of access to one's online accounts, we've been talking about it mostly in the death context up until this point. But certainly there are circumstances in one's life where they're incapacitated, where maybe they're not even incapacitated, but they want to execute a power of attorney that would be effective in the event that were to happen. I know you guys have been working, and Naomi pointed out to me, I don't think she was on air when she said it, so I'll say it now, that this whole process of drafting a uniform law for the states of the United States to take a look at and hopefully adopt is very transparent. It's happening in the open. You're getting lots of feedback from online service providers and basically anyone who's thought a lot about this and has a stake in how the law should look. So that's great to know. Can you fill us in on where people can look? Are there drafts of the uniform law that are available if people want to go deeper and take a look themselves?
Actually, there's even more than drafts. Everything mm-hmm. we've produced as a committee is available at uniformlaws.org. If you just Google uniform law, the Uniform Law Commission will come up, and then you can look for our drafting committee, and its title is Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets. So we have, we've had four meetings. So we have memos in information and various drafts that are all available online for anyone.
Great. That's wonderful to know. So back to my question on being incapacitated or executing a power of attorney. You know, my husband and I are constantly in the process of signing documents where we both have to be there. We've actually discussed, why don't we just sign power of attorneys for each other so that we maybe don't have to be there or we don't have to worry about that process. Is it even possible under various service providers' terms of service for a power of attorney to be effective?
Well, that's a good question. Most of the terms of service agreements, or some of them at least, prohibit someone else accessing an account. And so our act will facilitate access by an agent under a power of attorney by permitting that expressly.
Well, that's good. I think in California, we even have, Evan, I know you've written about this, an anti-impersonation statute that has come into play because of problems where someone has gone into someone's social media account and pretended to be them. So you might even, at least in California, be running up against a criminal liability if you were not to have the benefit of the uniform law that you all are working on.
Yeah, I'd never thought about that, but that is interesting. And it seems like, I mean, I haven't studied that statute or looked at it. I did write a blog post about some case a few years ago, and mm-hmm. you wonder when that would actually be triggered. It'd be something interesting to go look in that statute if it's something, you know, just merely accessing that in order to perform the duties of the fiduciary, you know, the executor of the estate or whatever, if that's going to trigger that. But I'm glad you brought that up, because I hadn't even thought of the potential criminal liability arising on something like that, like impersonation or identity theft or something like that.
Right.
It adds a whole nother dimension to it.
Be careful if you just decide to be someone's executor, because you're not sure, not just the headache that it involves, but could involve some criminal liability if you're not careful in how you do it.
You know, you'd have to be careful if you were the executor. You just want to be thinking about what it is that you would want to be doing through social media anyway, on behalf of that, on behalf of the, what they call it, the decedent, right? I'm so right. Rusty on my trusts and estates terminology, you know. So, but you know, there you'd want to, certainly a good executor is going to have some tact in the first place. And you want to be careful about any kind of public facing communications or what have you when it comes to that. It'd be weird to kind of perpetuate the decedent's identity in some way, don't you think?
Yes. No, you wouldn't want to masquerade as a dead person. That would be very creepy. The one thing I know that I have to do, you know, we can talk about all the ins and outs and the ethics of whether you access people's emails or not. But the one thing I know I have to do is give my next of kin access to the Amazon account we use, because we are in the subscribe and save program where they send stuff to the house. You know, it's all just automated and set up and it just keeps coming.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes.
You know, they're going to be drowning in toilet paper and paper towels if we can't turn that off. Please, Amazon, no more paper products.
Gosh, now I'm worried who's going to drink all my Tonks. You know, if
that's
anything
right.
happens to me, that's another thing. I've got to make these lists of things I've got to worry about. So,
right. Who gets the Tonks? And then the flip side of that, too, bills that need to be continued to be paid, despite the fact that someone has gone. I'm sure that preserving the assets of an estate would be first and foremost on someone's mind.
And you get these wacky situations too. I mean, there was a story not too long ago where, you know, there was, and this, I've seen at least two or three stories like this in the past couple of years where someone like dies in their apartment. And I think most recently it was a woman was died in the back seat of her Jeep in her garage, and nobody noticed for like 3 or 4 years because not until the house went into foreclosure, I guess all the money finally went out of the account or whatever. So, you know, if there's nobody who's like personally involved interacting with that individual on a day-to-day basis, they can sort of go into oblivion because of the stuff happening automatically. And nobody noticed until the creditors start knocking on the doors, you know, a few years later. There's like mummified bodies found in the backs of cars. Have you seen any of those stories?
Yes. It rings a terrible, creepy bell.
It's kind of Kafka-esque, yeah.
Yeah, it does. Back to burning the papers again. Okay, Susie, so my next question for you, apart from the access to accounts and terms of service making the user the exclusive user of their account, we also talk a lot about the show about the fact that many digital assets just grant you a license. So
correct.
If you've downloaded a bunch of iTunes music, that license in all likelihood does not extend to your being able to pass that along to heirs, even though, you know, there may have been thousands or tens of thousands or even more money spent amassing some digital asset library. Maybe books are another good example that people collect
example.
During their lifetime. So how is the Uniform Law Commission dealing with that issue?
So Naomi came up with, I thought, a brilliant solution. And what we've done is we've made it clear in the act that the fiduciary steps into the shoes of the account holder. Therefore, the fiduciary has all of the account holder's rights, but no more. That means if the account holder could assert a right to give or bequeath the digital account contents, then so could the fiduciary. But it doesn't turn, let's say it's irrefutable that the account holder only has a license and the account holder has no cause of action to assert more than that. So then the fiduciary wouldn't be able to turn around and say, content provider, you have to give me the ability to transfer this account. The fiduciary would only be able to do what the account holder could. So long story short, if account holder can claim that the Apple iTunes account should be transferable,
then so could the fiduciary. But if the account holder can't, the fiduciary can't.
So we were talking before about how you be careful before you agree to be someone's executor, because if you're not careful, you could run afoul of a criminal impersonation statute, as in California. Now, perhaps it's a good thing to be an executor, because if you're stepping into the shoes of someone with a vast iTunes collection, I guess you could continue to enjoy it while the estate is being wound up.
That we actually covered, and not quite. So what we analogize that to is, forget before the computer era, before anything was digital. Take, for example, a country club membership. The executor administering the estate or whomever might have to address that asset to administer the estate or manage the incapable person's assets. So perhaps someone dies, they have a country club membership, and the spouse has a right to receive it. The executor would step in and transfer the ownership per the country club rules, but they could never go play 18 holes or use the clubhouse. So that's the analogy we've been using. Not so fast. You can't do everything.
Can't crash the clubhouse. I love it.
That's right.
All right. So you guys have been working away, and you're honing in on having a uniform law available for prime time by summer. Does it look like that's going to happen?
It will. We'll have a draft ready for the July annual meeting. I think our reading is scheduled for the 14th, which is a Monday. And then what happens is at the end of the conference, I think that Thursday, there's a vote. All the commissioners from all the states vote, assuming we're approved. Then there's some fine tuning that's done to the draft to, you know, make sure there's no glitches in it. And it comes out and is actually published on the Uniform Law Commission website sometime in the fall. That means it's then available as a conference product for each state to enact.
So although we have access to the law, and I'm glad of that, and all your meetings and records and what the work in progress is, can you hit some of the high points for us on controversial issues? How have you come down on some of the problematic areas?
I would say the most controversial issue has been how we treat the terms of service agreements. So what we do is we say, fiduciary is subject to the terms of service agreement, except in one sense. We want to, and are still working on the provision that would do that, but we will have a provision that says that the terms of service agreement can't, in what I would call boilerplate, wipe out fiduciary rights. So in other words, the account holder could decide, I don't want my lawyer, Susie Walsh, when she's administering my estate, to access my account. I'm going to write that into my will. I don't want my wife, when she's administering my estate, to have access to any digital assets. I can put that in my will. I could even check a box if the option is offered when I establish the account. But if it's buried in some language in a terms of service agreement that flashes quickly on a screen, and that buried language says no fiduciary access, we're going to say that that's not enforceable. The service providers, needless to say, don't like that idea. They would like to be able to just incorporate that option into the terms of service. So they'd like to sell a product. They'd like to be able to say, some of them, if you open up blah-blah-blah account, then there is no fiduciary access. You just wouldn't have it ever. And we would prefer that the default be all accounts have fiduciary access. In other words, there's no prohibition. If they want to add the prohibition, it would have to be like a checkbox. So we've been back and forth on that, and that's been difficult.
How did the online service providers say that they have an infrastructure in place, or are they complaining about the burdens that are involved when everybody's lost uncle is their next of kin and wants to have access to their account?
You mean just generally giving fiduciary access at all? I think initially they expressed a concern of account identification because, as we know, anybody can open up a free email account. You don't use your real name. You use whatever. I could use Fred the dog, and that could be my email address. So they had some questions about, well, how if you tell us John Smith died, we may not have anything that says John Smith has that account because you don't put in a social security number or anything like that. So there were concerns about authentication. They don't want to have to, they don't want our act to apply retroactively, let's say, to existing accounts. So if we're going to establish these rules about what the terms of service agreement can say, they're going to apply to new accounts.
Wow, that's huge.
Well, think about it, though. We can't very well establish a rule that says they have to put certain options in a terms of service agreement to existing accounts. It's going to have to be prospectively in certain regards.
That would probably be unconstitutional if you tried to do it otherwise, right?
I think it's impossible. It's unfair. They have very good arguments to make about freedom of contract and customer expectations. Mm-hmm. So there's practicalities that exist that we can't change. Let me think about other controversial provisions. The other conceptual difference we've had, maybe I'm overstating when I say the word difference, is any fiduciary steps into the shoes of the person they're representing. That's sort of the nature of what they do. And so in the old days, the fiduciary would be able to go through my desk. You can see on my messy desk, they would be able to go through all my papers and look for things they need to, inventory my assets, collect them, and distribute them. And so we've been arguing that the same rule should apply to digital assets unless the account holder indicates that he or she didn't want that to happen. The internet service providers that are subject to the federal privacy laws are very uncomfortable with fiduciary access at all because the federal statute doesn't mention fiduciaries. So you'll see if you were to review all the drafts, they all mention in connection with access to electronic communications content, they all mention subject, as permitted by federal law, because mm-hmm. the internet service providers that provide the public service and are subject to the privacy law want to make sure if a court held that they could not release the content. In other words, if a judge were to disagree with what we've done in the act, they want to be able to not make the disclosure. They don't want our act to mandate something that isn't permitted under the federal statute.
All right. Evan, do you have any more questions on the topic of your digital afterlife at all?
No, this has been a great conversation. We could talk about it for a long time, but I'm ready to move on if you are, Denise.
I am almost. I wanted to just ask, since we asked Naomi, I don't want to miss the chance to get Susie's take too. I think one of the hardest things for people to do along these lines, if they want to take proactive steps, I think it's great that there are going to be checkboxes and hopefully prominently displayed ones that help people do some management at the account level as opposed to the estate level. But if you're going to do this in your estate planning, getting a handle on all of your accounts and putting down the information necessary to access those accounts and knowing exactly what sort of access you're able to pass on is a really hard thing. And I'm wondering if you have any just sort of practical advice or tools, Susie.
First and foremost, we always talk to our clients about, we just say, we need you to think about this. We need you to let your family know or let us know or let someone know what to look for. I encourage couples to share information, or at least let, generally in a family or a marriage, there's one person who handles the bulk of the financial affairs, and that's the person who's got all the online access typically. And so I'm just encouraging my clients to think about that and think about leaving passwords accessible, using a service, doing something to anticipate that someday they may forget the passwords, lose the passwords, be incapable of accessing the account, and so forth. And also, when we're working with clients and they're thinking about, I'm going to do this for my kids and this person's going to be in charge and I might have a trust and I might have two trustees, we want them to think about who should have that access. you know, if you're just saying, you don't want to just say all my fiduciaries should have access to everything. You want to think about who's going to be in those roles. So if you're naming your children to be co-trustees, maybe you want your best friend who's the co-trustee to be the one to access and look through the digital files. Maybe you don't want to give your children that access. So I'm finding clients are very willing to think about that. And most of them are pretty eager to go home and start thinking about memorializing the passwords or using a service that will do that. Because when you actually think about how much would be lost if no one had that information, it's quite incredible.
Right. And it's certainly a tough balance too between memorializing on the one hand and ensuring security on the other.
Exactly.
To make sure that you're taking care of both ends of that problem. And it sounds like for the person who wants no access to be given to their accounts after their demise, that what I'm sort of gleaning from our conversation with Naomi and now with you, that the online service providers are trying to provide a quick option for that.
Yes. We call it a digital death. I'm sure Naomi mentioned that. And we have members of our committee who have clients who've asked them to make sure that they die digitally. They have information in digital form that they don't want their families to see in some cases. It might be a sensitive occupation or hobby or whatever. And so they want the equivalent of a literary executor over their digital assets. So they want to pick somebody who will come in, be armed with the information necessary to delete all those assets. And our act will facilitate that. We provide for client intent. We make it clear that you can say in your will, you know, I want the stuff deleted. I don't want anyone to have access.
All right. Well, I think that will be our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. That's digital death. For those of you who are listening and may need to demonstrate to some governing body that you have listened to or watched the show, digital death will be our second phrase. Evan, do you feel like you have a lot of homework to do to get your digital assets in order in case of your eventual demise?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly are some things to think about here. I mean, it's each of us is different when it comes to this, because, you know, I see a greater concern into, you know, ensuring that access to, bank accounts, insurance accounts, things like that are much more important than, you know, the social media stuff. But, you know, from a very practical, pragmatic level. But at the same time, I'm all into making sure that information is passed on for the sake of posterity to preserve our heritage and our culture and, you know, our, whether that be just our family heritage or whatever. So we can only expect that as we move toward cloud provided services for things like photo storage and, the collection of information, this is only going to increase in importance. So I think personally, I'm a little bit behind the curve, but, you know, often lawyers are the last people to think about the things that they counsel others to consider. I'm sure, Susie, you are aware of that phenomenon all too well, being, you know,
absolutely
in that area. Susie, so it's going to be important.
Evan mentioned something there that we haven't specifically talked about that we should, and that is photos, because people, you know, it's a big part of one's legacy. And I think that it's probably a huge concern that people do have access to the proxy memories of their deceased loved one.
Oh, sure. Just hang out at a Verizon store when a teenager gets a new phone. I've seen my kids just completely decompensate when their photos get lost in the transfer. You've never seen anything as traumatic as that. And it's interesting. Evan mentioned, he's concerned more with the financial access. And I think that's where I am. I have had clients who are much more concerned with ongoing access to the social media accounts and the photos. And there was even an interesting Boston Globe piece a while back about preserving voicemails. There are people who really like to preserve voicemails. And when suddenly a date passes by and the account expires, they're very distraught. So it is a very personal issue. And we've talked at length in our committee about Dropbox and how that will be important to a lot of people where they store material on, in the cloud?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you could see a family's whole digital archive being stored somewhere like Dropbox and needing to be passed along from generation to generation.
You know, there's a really big irony here because we talk about this a lot in the copyright context of there's this problem of the perfect digital copy and it can be replicated so easily and distributed so easily. But isn't it ironic that, you know, there are these problems that are presented from digital archives that are placed somewhere safe, you know, safe from your house burning down. You know, if you have your photo collection on Flickr and your house burns down, it's not the same as having the one copy of the album destroyed. But isn't it ironic that there's, you know, in one sense, the digital media has so much more integrity and so much more staying power and so much more resiliency to being destroyed. But at the same time, you know, the old flimsy old photo album is much easier to, devise, bequeath to the next generation.
Yes.
Yeah. And generation's the interesting or the operative word to me because I have a lot of conversations with my teens about this. And I've tried, you know, I'm obviously the older generation in the family, and I've tried to say, everything's here in this file. Here's the name of the file. Here's the password. Here's how you can access the photos from my phone. And the kids aren't really embracing that. And yet when I say to them, you know, somebody ought to be able to get into your Twitter account or get into whatever, and they're horrified. They don't want even to think about giving a parent access to that. And the flip side of it is we've had sad cases of teenagers dying, and my kids have said to me, well, you know, so-and-so's Twitter feed is still live. I don't think her parents know that all of that is still out there. So there's a lot of these issues that I think the generations treat differently. The kids are very protective of the social media accounts that they use and whatever that might be in any given hour. You know, they change.
All right. Well, let us move on from this topic more focused on the grave to some of those assets that might be in one's digital estate, those Bitcoins you've all been amassing. We got a word from the IRS just this week on how it's going to treat Bitcoins for taxation purposes. It's not all that surprising. It hasn't come out and said that it's going to treat it as a currency, but yet it's going to be sure and tax them. Can you tell us a bit about how that's going to work, Susie?
Sure. My understanding is Bitcoin is a convertible currency, which means it can be used outside of the digital realm to pay for things in the real world. That is called apparently a convertible currency. So the IRS came out and said, we're going to treat this just like stock or an asset that you buy and sell. So if you acquire a Bitcoin at $1 and when you spend it, it was worth $100, you've realized $99 in gain. And that would be reported as a taxable event on that year's tax return. Likewise, if you're paid in Bitcoin and the Bitcoin, when you're paid with it, is worth $100, you've realized $100 in income. It's as if you received $100 in real dollars. I think that creates a lot of what we call compliance issues, because I think it's difficult to figure out who's going to issue the tax statements that show those transactions. I don't know that Merrill Lynch is going to be following people around and issuing Bitcoin 1099s, or I don't know how people are going to track that, given what I've read about the Bitcoin exchanges.
Do you think there will be some kind of threshold for any transaction above a certain dollar amount where the IRS is going to require that somebody be doing the taxation documentation?
I would think. I don't know when they're going to issue those regulations, or who is working on that or considering it, but certainly it would be very difficult to tax thousands of transactions with very small, you know, gains and fluctuations. And likewise, it can depreciate. You could incur a loss.
Mm. Right. So. And the other thing I've seen in the coverage is a difficulty in pinpointing the precise valuation at the time of sale, that, you know,
exactly.
How are you? I guess that's true of other kinds of property too. You're always just kind of estimating.
Just give the government the blockchain, right? Couldn't they track everything that way?
Yeah, you might be able to track Bitcoin more easily than you could, say, the house Maybe. Down the street.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, it'll be interesting to see. And I don't want to be the first person to have to prepare that 1040. That's going to be hard. Maybe we have to ask all our clients that now. Have you had any Bitcoin transactions?
And how many are saying yes?
I haven't had anybody say yes.
All right. Evan, you have your model one from China.
Yes. Indeed. Have it right here. So I'm just waiting till till it gets to be a lot and I try to cash it in and I realize that it has no cash value. So
yeah. Oh, so sad. There we go. Yeah. If Bitcoins were real, they might look like that.
Just put it under my pillow anyway.
Yeah, see what the tooth fairy does with that thing. Or leave it for one of your kids and maybe they'll cry. Maybe not.
Yes.
All right. Well, we have some tips and resources to leave you with here at the end of the show. Our resources mostly relate to the topic that has taken up most of the show, planning for your digital demise, or at least planning for how you want your digital assets and digital life treated in the event you can't manage it yourself. Naomi, from the top of the show, Naomi Kahn, wrote a great article called Postmortem Life Online that we flagged as one of our resources that you should check out. You can check out it and all the rest of the discussion points that we've talked about today at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/252. She also alluded to the fact that Google has an inactive account manager. This is something I'd never seen before. So if you are a heavy Google user, you should check it out. It says it's a way for users to share parts of their account data or notify someone if they've been inactive for a certain period of time. So here is something that you can do today to go in and decide exactly who you want to have what access to your Google account. How long has this been in effect, Susie? Do you know?
I believe it was April of 2013 they came out with that feature. And that allows the user to govern postmortem access, or I don't believe it covers access during incapacity. But it's a great step, and we have applauded Google for being the first to do that.
Well, I don't know if it distinguishes, because all it looks at is inaction on the
inactivity
account. Yeah.
Right.
So but then it notifies someone, and right, that person has access to certain things.
I think, yeah, you're right. I think it's geared more to access and cleanup as opposed to ongoing access for a temporary incapacity. But you are correct that it could allow access before someone dies if they've simply not used the account.
Right. So go check it out, people. See if it makes sense for you to fill out its requirements. And then a couple more resources along these lines. A blog that I came across in doing research for this show is called Digital Passing at digitalpassing.com. It's written by a lawyer named Jim Lamb. He has lots of good coverage of these kinds of issues. And also a site that Naomi referenced in one of her articles. It's called The Digital Beyond. TheDigitalBeyond.com, much like the Digital Passing blog, covers these issues in detail, has various resources and discussions that you should look at if you are looking at these kinds of concerns. And then, Evan, you put in our tip for this week. You want to take that one?
Yes, it's an interesting article from the ABA Journal, the American Bar Association. The title is "Axe These Terms from Your Legal Writing." You know, we from time to time love talking about anachronisms in legal writing and how we can make our legal writing better. So this is a nice little list of and a discussion of why certain things ought to be left out of legal writing, and for that matter, all writing, if you really want to improve. So some are no surprises to the list, like the word herein. You know, that smacks of legalese, smacks you right across the face of legalese. It's ambiguous. Know all men by these presents. I mean, I have to admit, I've run across that, but not in any contract written before. or not in any contract written after the year probably 1950. some of them are surprising to be on the list, though, like pursuant to. You know, that's one that I'll have to think about because I still use that in contracts. But, you know, it really should just mean, you know, it really just means required under the contract. The word shall. I know the word shall is problematic, and I just think it generally sounds better, reads better if you use the word will instead, but there can be some ambiguities that one needs to be concerned about. So it's if you just do a search for axe these terms from your legal writing, it's an article by Brian Garner on the ABA Journal website, which is good for any writer, especially lawyers, to make themselves clearer communicators.
This is great. I love Frank Easterbrook, Judge Frank Easterbrook's comments about shall. I guess he wrote in an opinion, the word is like a chameleon. It changes its hue sentence to sentence. Abjure it, forswear it. You shan't regret it.
That is great. You know, Judge Easterbrook, of course, here in the Seventh Circuit, he's the one who wrote the famous Law Review article about internet law and the law of the horse. So we all love this area of the law. We need to be Frank Easterbrook friends.
I knew he sounded familiar.
Yes.
All right. Well, with that, I think we're just about ready to say farewell for the weekend to all of you who have joined us. We're so glad that you have. If you've joined us at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC on a Friday, that means you watched us live. That's when we record this show. But you may be joining us at some other time, some unspecified time in the future. You're time traveling while you're listening to this show. And the way you can do that is to go to twit.tv/twill. Our whole archive is there. You can go back and find other shows that we've done with other great guests. You can find this show there. You can also find it at youtube.com/thisweekinlaw, where we have another archive of the shows available for your listening pleasure. If you're someone who likes to subscribe and have the shows delivered to you so you don't have to go hunt them down, if you use iTunes, we're available there. And all our RSS feeds and the means that you need to accomplish that are available on our show page. What else? You should get in touch with us between the shows. You should email us if you'd like, if you want things to be private and maybe perhaps someday accessible to our heirs and assigns with that degree of privacy caveat thrown in. You should email Evan at evan.twit.tv or me at denise.twit.tv. Over on Twitter, he is Internet Cases. I'm D. Howell there. Plus, we have Facebook and Google Plus pages for the show where you can expound in far more detail than you could on Twitter, although we enjoy going back and forth with you in any medium whatsoever. So let us know about topics that you'd like to hear more about, guests that you'd like to hear from, and what you think about what we're doing here at This Week in Law. We love hearing from you. And Susie, this has been a real pleasure. We really appreciate your taking the time. Sorry for the technical glitches and delays, but we're glad we could get you on the show.
Not a problem. Thanks so much for having me.
And we look forward to the commission's draft on fiduciary powers and access to digital assets later on this summer.
Thank you.
Evan, great chatting with you.
It was great chatting with you as well. This is a pretty provocative topic, you know, and one that I think it's like we were saying earlier, it's going to require more and more attention as time goes on. So I'm glad we can have these conversations now and sort of being able to see what's going to be more relevant in the future. So really enjoyed it. Susie, nice talking with you. Thanks for
nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Great. Yes, yeah. Really enjoyed it.
My takeaway from the topic is there's a huge market opportunity here that somebody, you know, and people are already coming up with ways to manage your assets in a secure way and share what you want to share in an effective way. So I think that the tools to manage this are going to be key on a go-forward basis. And we'll keep an eye on them and keep you apprised of them as they come to our attention. So thanks so much for joining us on This Week in Law. We'll see you next week. Take care.